Welcome to A Lust for Life's new parenting podcast series. I'm your host, Ciara O'Connor Walsh. A Lust for Life is a mental health charity on a mission to educate and empower the children and young people of Ireland through early prevention mental health programmes, content and advocacy. And we also want to support the adults in our children and young people's lives, parents, teachers, guardians and friends, by giving you the tools that you need to be that one good adult in a child's life. And that is what this podcast is all about. So join us as we explore the joys and challenges and complexities of parenthood through compassionate conversations, interviews, and real-life parenting stories. We're here to provide you with practical tips, support, and resources to help you parent with a little more ease and to nurture both your child's and your own mental health. Dr. Coleman Nochter is a mental health nurse and psychotherapist with a special interest in child and adolescent mental health and psychoanalytic psychotherapy. And Coleman, you have an array of international clinical expertise and you're particularly interested in the area of new media and technology and its impact on children. So we're definitely going to get into that today. So Coleman is an author, public speaker, regular contributor to print, broadcast media. You will have heard his voice on the radio. You will have heard him on podcasts. He has a regular parenting column in the Irish Examiner. And you're also the host of the popular Asking for a Parent podcast. And author of Cop On, What It Is and Why Your Child Needs It to Thrive and Survive in Today's World. And your new book, The 4-7 Zone, an easy and effective way to live a balanced life and become your own therapist. So Coleman, look, you help countless parents through all of your books and radio appearances and podcasts, as well as in a clinical setting. Because you have your finger on the pulse of the issues that are facing parents today, I thought I might ask you, what are those really big issues? What are the themes that you see in your clinical practice that are coming up again and again?
Yeah, thanks, Ciara. I mean, I think undoubtedly, if you were to answer that question in one word, you would say anxiety, right? So from the point of view of I'm working with families for 25 years, and it's certainly been the thing that has become the most predominant, most pervasive issue that both parents and children present with. So I've never in all the time that I'm doing this seen as many anxious children as I see now. And likewise, I've never met as many anxious parents as I do now. So I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. But to drill into anxiety and say, well, why is everybody so anxious? You know, that's the real question. And I think there's societal issues at play, I think. And if I was to, again, use one word, I think expectation has become a huge issue, you know, in terms of our expectations of ourselves, our expectations as parents, as teenagers, as children. It's almost off the charts from the point of view of we almost all need to make an impact and be impressive and be all-rounders. And, you know, and again, I'm not entirely sure why that is. I think, of course, there's the kind of social media comparison that has kind of contaminated our worldview in many ways. We're looking at the highlight reels of people's lives all the time. There's also that idea of, you know, I suppose a change in how we see ourselves in the world, you know, the idea of our expectations of our work, like a job for life is probably a thing that doesn't exist anymore. You don't have to, you know, there used to be a thing of if you work hard, good things will happen, you know, almost it's, you know, good things need to happen and they need to happen all the time. And, you know, even from the point of view of our sports, academics, social performances, it's, you know, the bar is just raising and raising, raising each time. And I think many children and parents are perhaps struggling with that endless increase in expectation. If I could capture it in one word, I think we have demonized average, right? So if we think about average, average is where most people will be. So if you have a room of 10 people, one will be exceptional, one will struggle, and eight will be average. But now in recent times, average is always kind of, it's either follows only average or just average, right? And everyone wants to be above average, right? So that's a shift in how we've seen the world. Average should be something that's met with relief, not disappointment, right? But if we consign 80% of the world to feel that average is not enough, then we consign 80% of the population to feel disenfranchised, disgruntled, unhappy, from that point of view. And so, like I would always say, give yourself, do a social experiment. When people ask you tomorrow how you're doing, tell them you're having an average day, and I guarantee you they'll say, "Why, what's wrong?" So from that point of view, if you can think about the lens through which we see the world, and if average becomes not enough, then obviously anxiety, feeling endless desires for improvement, and that sense of enough becomes very distorted when we're constantly chasing rainbows in that way. And I think as a society, as parents and as children, I think teenagers, younger children, even you see children sweating over a second year geography summer test, and you're going, why?
Who
Why?
cares?
Yeah. And they care because
They
they're
do, yeah.
told it's they have to care. They're told this is, your leaving cert's only X amount of years away, and everyone else is getting brilliant in this, and all of that sort of stuff. Where there's much more of a spotlight and a microscope sometimes on every aspect of what we do. It's natural that we would apply that same microscope to our own lens of how we see things. And much of the anxiety may not be externally imposed upon by other people. Many times it's ourselves. It's our own internal critic. That's not enough. That's not good enough. I need to be better. But sorry, I'm going a long way around in explaining this, but I think we have lost the concept of enough. And when you lose enough, then you never can feel content. And even in the way in which we, if you claim to have enough, you could be accused of settling. Oh, you're losing your drive because you're content. So there's the way in which the world is set up at the moment. It's almost anti-balance. It's certainly anti-regulation in terms of something stable. And what we have is a very volatile experience of the world. And I think it comes into many people's expectations of the world is different. And while I would say anxiety is a big issue, I don't know whether we're almost over-pathologizing lots of aspects of life. The idea of that worry, all not all worry is anxiety, not all sadness is depression. But if we say that worry and sadness shouldn't exist and we try and fix them, then we pathologize them. Sometimes worry that we are pathologizing life problems, life issues, which are about discontent and about failure and about disappointment. But in the world that almost doesn't accept that that should happen, because the expectation is higher, because the pressure is higher, it makes us feel like we're struggling more than we maybe actually are.
Absolutely. And I mean, I just feel like that concept of average, like I fell into the trap straight away when you said average. I interpreted that as bad, not enough, not good enough, like less than, because the bar is higher. And I don't think it was like that when I was growing up as a child. Like, I don't remember like being told, like I didn't remember the second year geography class test mattering that much. Like my mom wouldn't even ask me what results I got, I don't think. And she was a teacher in my school, So she was very education focused. But I do think that there seems to be a lot more pressure academically and everywhere. But yeah, I think that everything has to be this excellent.
Yeah, and I think parents have a contribution to that as well, from the point of view of we've never been as involved in our children's lives as we are now. I can tell you that I played GAA and I played soccer and played rugby all my life. My father probably was at a handful of my games, but not certainly every training session, every match. So when we're involved to that extent, when we're doing our homework with our children, when we are sharing our children's summer test results on the family WhatsApp group, when we are, all of that stuff feeds into that need to perform and that pressure that when there's more interest and investment, then there's more consequence. So, if I have to tell five people about my geography summer test, or I have to tell nobody about it, that's the difference. But within the peer group, the focus is the same. I think there's an increased competitiveness in school environments, and how did you do? What did you get? That sort of stuff. Don't really remember that being part of my secondary school experience. Did you pass? Yeah, nice one. And that, there was a kind of a sense of that. But to get back to the average thing, average is determined by the group of people. It's not like if you're, no matter what the standard is, most people will be average. So if you've 10 golfers who are professionals, there'll still be an average in the professionals. And you've 10 golfers who've never played before and they play one round, there'll still be an average. There's an average everywhere. Do you know what I mean? So as the standard goes up, you don't get. Not everyone, I would say, no, we all can't be special. By definition, special is a select few. Do you know what I mean? But if we all feel that we're not enough because we're not special, that's the difference. Do you know what I mean? And there is a drive for specialness, for to be in, to make an impact. And I was a kind of a, there was a moment in my career that this kind of changed, and it was around 8 or 9 years ago, even I'd say maybe, and I met this young person who, and she had made a very serious attempt on her life, and she was in leaving cert year, and we talked about it. I've written about this before, and I was trying to go through her history to try and find out what was going on. There was nothing in this kid's history. She was very capable, very lots of friends, blah, blah, blah. And she said, "My problems are not in my past, Coleman. They're in my future." And she said, "What have I got to look forward to?" She said, "I'm going to do my leaving cert. Probably going to go to college, hopefully meet someone, get a job, get married, have a few kids, and die. That's not enough for me." Right. And I remember my first instinct was, you've basically just described my life, right? Number one. And secondly, it was like, this is the millennial entitlement. And this is, I was thinking in my own head, this is ridiculous. But it doesn't matter whether I think it's ridiculous or not. The risk. Her risk was no less, whether I agreed with it or not. So I said, and then I thought about it. And she grew up in this Instagram world where it was, you have to make an impact, be the all that you can be. You can have anything you can wish for, and all of this. And that's not that kind of like, you can't have everything you want, and you can't, the only thing stopping you is your lack of belief. No, it's not. There's lots of things that stop us being these things. So if I'm not succeeding, it's my fault because I don't believe it enough. Do you know what I mean? And this is a girl at 18 years of age who had already believed that she had thrown away her chance. So from that point of view, but for me, it was about, okay, I need to meet her where she's at, not where I want her to be. Do you know what I mean? And I think as adults, we sometimes dismiss this kind of view of, oh, silliness. It's not, that doesn't matter whether you think it's silly or not. This person still needs help to kind of adjust the lens through which she sees the world. And there's so much contamination and influence on that lens by saying to you, you're not enough if you don't have this, you're not enough if you don't have that. That stuff about be all that you can be is not reassuring, it's pressuring. Do you know what I mean? And if I'm not sure what age you are, but for me, growing up now versus when I was growing up in the 80s and early 90s, it bears no resemblance to that world. The world that young people are inhabiting with that pressure and that gaze and that stress and that expectation. Yeah, it's a different world. It's a different world, you know?
And parents are parenting in that context as well, and are, even though I did, and I'm the same age as you, it sounds like, but grew up in that time pre-social media, remember it very well. Didn't have a computer until I went to college in the late 90s. Like 1997 was the first time I had access to a computer to actually look something up on the internet. So very, very strong memories of what it was like to live outside of that context. And yet, when I have my child's birthday, if I put up a picture of that on Instagram, the lad I sat beside in French class in 1996 is going to see it, right? So, it's just like this idea that you can't, I suppose the pressure to put things on social media because you want to share fun things and celebrations with your friends and family who can't be there. And equally, you have this audience now, and I think we all have this audience, and it's so hard not to feel like sometimes you're performing. And especially with parenting, and I see people around me that they are performing parenting in a lot of ways, you know, and they feel like they need to meet this invisible standard in their parenting. And I think that standard being so high, I mean, even as you were talking there, I was thinking the expression good is good enough came into my head. And I was like, actually, good is good. Good is not good enough. Good is good. So we're all operating in that context. And if that's going to be influencing our parenting, and therefore it's going to have a massive influence on our children.
Yeah, but I would challenge that good is not good enough anymore. You know what I mean? Like, if you're getting, you know, if you, your kid comes home with a series of goods on a excellent, very good, good, unsatisfactory, there's a frown comes after that.
Yeah, where's the says, very good and excellent?
Yeah, what are you doing? And again, the performance, you're absolutely correct about performance. And I think that's a huge element of it, because it doesn't, the performing of the using your example of putting the picture of the birthday, whatever, that in and of itself is fine. But then the party next week that someone else shares is twice as impressive as yours, which makes you feel not enough that you didn't, you know, you had a bouncy castle and party bags, but they're going for a weekend away in a spa for a 10-year-old's birthday. You know what I mean? So you're kind of going, oh my God. And that seeps, that pressure seeps down. If I'm looking at something, I'm going, oh my God, Kira's 9-year-old has a black belt in Taekwondo. And then I go, my 9-year-old, and I'm going, you still have Velcro shoes. Like, why are you not as good as this kid? You know? And so that seeps in. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And it is. And parental guilt, parental competition, parental impressiveness, you know, we add to this. Child comes home from sport, two questions that you ask. Did you win? Did you score? Right? They're out of your mouth before you know it. Do you know what I mean? If your child comes home with all the good ticks on the report card, why not very good? If they come back and say, I didn't study for that and I got 20 out of 40. Imagine what you could have got if you studied, you know, rather than us, you know, there's almost like, if you think, I always think children's sport is a really interesting symptom of this. If you think about all the problems of children's sport, the silent sidelines, the referees going on protest, not, you know, the fesh fixing, you know, even when it's never 2 9-year-olds are fighting on the pitch. These are not children's problems. They're adult problems. These are all adult problems. Adults becoming over-involved in children's lives and losing the run of themselves, you know, from that point of view. And so as the adults in the room, we can't just say social media is destroying our children or smartphones or, you know, subcontract that responsibility out. We have to go, actually, we might be playing a role in this as well, you know, and this pressure and this expectation and this anxiety. Yeah, there's a recipe to this, and we're an ingredient in that recipe for sure. Do you know what I mean? That's the stuff we can control. We can't just say, oh, it's, you know, the likes of these big companies have to take responsibility. We as individuals have to, you know, I would say when it comes to the technology issue, and this is maybe where my thinking has moved on, it's maybe not about regulating technology. It's almost about regulating human desire. Do you know what I mean? It's about regulating our own sense of what we decide is enough, because that tyranny of choice and that hyper comparative culture, it's fueling it, you know. That performance thing is really interesting, because I describe this as the Tinderization of society. So if you think about Tinder and this swipe left, swipe right stuff, so every part of your energy has to be invested in the profile, so your image, your witty one-liner, your interesting hobbies, whatever, because that will decide whether you get swiped left or right. Right. So it's understandable that the performative elements of who we are, that's where the investment is. Nobody's interested in what's behind the performance. So I don't really know or care about your kindness or your generosity or your, you know, humor or your interests. I want to, so we as a society have become almost obsessed with the profile, obsessed with the outward looking bit. And that's why I think we have created a situation where we feel under pressure all the time because you're performing. And it's, you know, the way in which you said it before, we used to be consumers of media. Now we're all producers of media. Do you know what I mean? Which goes with it a kind of a celebrity bit. If you're performing as this person, you almost like the likes of Beyonce can't go down to get a chicken fillet roll in her tracksuit because she drops the standard of what people expect. If your expectation or your hoped for self is what you're telling people you are as a family, then your kid can't get a D or an F in an exam because that's not part of the performance that you're putting out. Does that make sense? So all that inherent pressure feeds down into the system. And that's why the under 11s football game is more important now than it was 20 years ago. That's why the summer geography test in second year is more important. It's because we're placing importance on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard you talk before, Coleman, about creating a family culture and kind of leading from values rather than having a big load of arbitrary rules that may or may not make sense to your child. And I think at this conversation about standards and what's acceptable and what you need to be shooting for and everything all feeds into that idea of having shared values as a family. I remember when I first started working with the Lust for Life, doing a values workshop and going, God, I don't think, and I was 40 at the time, going, I don't think I've ever sat down and thought about my values. And I've heard you say before on the radio once about, you get married and you have children with somebody and you may never have had a conversation about what your values are. And then all of a sudden you're doing a job, which is parenting, which is so heart-centered, so value-centered, so about what you stand for. And that's where, conflict can happen. So how do you go about creating this family culture or creating a culture that comes from a place of values where you can have these conversations about the context that we all live in, but that children will be able to understand and feel held by, the values that you share as a family?
Yeah, I mean, I think that oftentimes values are sometimes dictated to us. You need to value this. This is more important than that. And we're all susceptible to marketing and all that impress. This is what you need, when in actual fact, that's what you want. What you want and what you need are different things. And so within families, I think there is, with all the anxiety the parents will say about, I think my job has been taken over by tablets, and that my children are spending so much more time on these devices. Family culture still holds the key in terms of determining a value system that your children will adopt. Now, there's a chance that if that value system is very rigid or very intense, they might actually buck against it and adopt a completely different one, or they might try out those different value systems as they go. But the value system is the core pillar of who we are, like in terms of what is important to me, and while I might feel that getting good grades or having impressive accolades or being a, those are the things I'm told I should value. But actually what I value is not being alone. I value company. I value authenticity. I value honesty, and we can all trot these things out, but our values will be different depending on who we are. And so the idea that within my family, a huge value that I would have is politeness and courtesy, right? I just think it costs nothing to say please and thank you, right? And that is a bugbear of mine with my children. You never say ask for anything without saying please and thank you, and I'd prompt them and all that sort of stuff, because that's a value that's important to me. Now, the idea of, say, for example, there was some research recently that if you have an Alexa in your house, people don't say please and thank you because they say, Alexa, play this. Alexa, stop. You're not expected to say please and thank you to an Alexa. And I was going to go, I was outraged that this would happen, that we would lose that common courtesy of those exchanges. But I would see that as a priority within my family. That's not going to be the same in everyone's house. The other people might have different values in that. But it's just an example of, and I definitely see that as having had a successful payoff in terms of how my children are around other people. Even when I'm not there, I can hear from a distance, they are courteous and they're polite. And I love getting the comments and your kids are so kind. Like he came up and asked me, could he have another thing or whatever. And so that standard that you set for yourself, we all have to have those within our families that say, this is a value of us. So the doctors, we say please and we say thank you and we appreciate that. And we never do this and we wouldn't, look down on other people or whatever it might be. And you try and set those things. Those are kind of the things that invest in terms of a child's self-value, self-worth, and in turn, hopefully their self-belief. So they have these core pillars. For me, we have made a mistake in that we've overvalued self-confidence at the cost of self-worth. So confidence is how I project myself outwardly, and I can be very confident at certain things, but my self-worth is very different, and that's my own relationship with myself. Does that make sense? And so if I'm going to have a good relationship with myself, I have to have a value system that I hold myself accountable to. And how close I am to that value system is my self-worth. So if I have a situation where something goes wrong, or if it, sit in a therapy session and a kid says, "You're the crap therapist," and I'm, "You're rubbish," and walks out, I have a choice. I can either give up my career and say that I'm rubbish at that and that's awful, or I can say it's all their fault and there's nothing wrong with me, or else I can think about it. And when I think about it, I think about it in terms of my values. I try my best. Maybe that wasn't my best hour. I try to be a good dad. I try to be a good brother. I try and live my life as best as I can. I don't intentionally go out to hurt people. I don't, that's not so. So my values become the thing that offers me context. It offers me perspective. It offers me stability from that point of view. So yes, that wasn't a great experience, but in the context of all these other things, it's going to be okay. Whereas if it's always about my confidence is fragile. You tack that, the whole thing falls apart. Does that make sense? And so
Yeah.
for me, the values, they're the things that are behind the profile. They're the things that are solids. There are kind of pillars and building blocks and the foundation of who we are. The other stuff is just window dressing, from the point of view of what comes afterwards. But I worry about our values not being discussed or not being talked about or not being known, that we don't establish them, because what we say are our values and what we might be doing might be in contrast to that. We have a great deal of emphasis in culture about our rights. We don't have as much of a conversation about our responsibilities, and I think for me, there's a lot of emphasis on, what we're entitled to, but there's not a greater degree of conversation around what we're obliged to provide, And I would always say, even when it comes to technology, having a smartphone is not a human right, it's a responsibility. You earn the right by showing the responsibility. It's not, it's that kind of process is really important, I think, from the point of view of our responsibilities as humans as well as our entitlement. And maybe again, that's somewhere where I think our society has such an emphasis on what you are entitled to, as opposed to what you're obliged to contribute.
Yeah, very interesting. It's just a shift of focus, but it's so important. And I mean, I'm thinking about my own parenting and do I place enough emphasis on responsibility? And it goes back to like how you support your child and validate your child. And this is something you talk about quite a bit, how to support and validate your child and the importance of validation and how it's such a great thing and everything to just, that it's okay and your feelings are normal. And a friend of mine always talks about tutting and clucking and just going, oh, jeez. Sometimes you don't even have to say anything to a small child. That's enough to just that empathy piece. But at what point then does the constant validation have to stop, right? So, like, then when your child is coming home going, I don't like a boy in my class, so I like spat at him, or something crazy like that happens. You're not going to go, oh, you poor thing, you had to deal with someone you didn't like. No, ju-ju-ju. So it's difficult because the messages for parents is this, empathize with your child, validate your child, offer unconditional support, be the soft place to fall. And then the child turns 7, 8, and all of a sudden, it's not always the right thing to do.
Yeah, and again, I think how much is too much
Yes,
is
that's
the
the
issue. And
question, I
that's
think.
really a difficult thing to say. But I think that changes. So for me, if you're looking at parenting, a bit like being a therapist, your role is to become redundant. So when you are no longer required, you have done your job well. So it is about, one of the greatest skill sets of the parent is being able to pace your introduction and your stepping back, right? So you offer children the right amount of surmountable stress so that they learn a skill and they can get through it and they have experience of manageable adversity, and then you support them where they need it, and you withdraw as they get more capable. And the process of childhood is a process of disillusionment. So when I'm 4, I think I'm Spider-Man, and when I'm 8, I'm thinking, hang on, there's other people here think they're Spider-Man as well. And then when I'm 12, I realize, gosh, I'm not Spider-Man at all. And when I'm 14, I couldn't feel any way further from Spider-Man, right? So that process is the introduction of reality is a process as you grow older. It is introduced. And as parents, we introduce reality. We kind of help decide the pace of that introduction. Introduce it too early, traumatized. That's what trauma is, being exposed to something that you're not socially, cognitively, or emotionally able to do. But delay reality, and we make people naive and disable their ability to cope. So when you're talking about validation, how you validate a 2-year-old and a 12-year-old and a 22-year-old are different. There's different levels because as they're getting older, the expectation that they would be able to take on more responsibility, to make better choices, is, and their accountability for their choices becomes much greater. So the idea around pacing that is part of that's the part of the dial that the parent manages. And the task of childhood is emotional regulation. So if you're 2-year-old going to Aldi and you don't get a pair of buttons or a packet of buttons, you have a tantrum. By the time you're 22, you hope you don't do that anymore because you've learned over those 2 decades to regulate emotion. And our job is to teach regulation, right? And that involves the parenting side. And I'd be very critical of the parenting thing that's you have to be softly spoken all the time and never raise your voice. And that's bullshit, excuse me. In it's not how parenting works. If your child doesn't see you becoming angry, upset, or frustrated, then how do they know that their behavior is having that effect? So within reason, you have to be able to say, that's annoying me, or that upset me, or I didn't like the way you did that, or you have to be able to have that commentary. And again, as parents, we're obviously wanting to respond all the time, not react. So react is, you reply to the feeling that you have in that moment. A response is a much more measured, thoughtful process of kind of contemplating it, that we all react from time to time. But it doesn't stop us responding upon reflection and going back and saying that wasn't my finest hour, but maybe don't draw with your crayons on my newly painted wall, or whatever it is that we want to do. So the process of that learning curve as becoming a parent and failing and lapsing and making mistakes, that's part and parcel of the process. Do you know what I mean? And again, that's about reducing the expectation of the parent to be perfect, to have that. And it's almost allowing you to kind of decide how much is enough, how much is too much. And what is good enough? Do you know what I mean? And for me, that's the Everest of parenting, is trying to get that pace right. And I think it's done by trial and error. Too much, too little, too much, too little. But in the process, you're kind of muddling through as you continue to miss the mark from time to time. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes you'll mollycoddle your child to the point of going, well, I should have let him manage that himself. And another day you let him off too far and he'll struggle and you'll go, oh, I need to maybe be more present in that moment for that. But parenting is aspirational. You're aspiring to parent, and through that process, hopefully children get through it. But the idea of it being in any way plottable, perfect, or that you could like, and again, we go back to maybe too much information. I can guarantee you my mother never read a parenting book
I
for
know,
me.
yeah, no, I know, my mom did either.
So from that point of view, less is more, maybe a little bit in that way. And again, I think sometimes, as we've seen, we're villains of overcomplicating things. And that's not just as parents, as members of society, we kind of can overcomplicate it, sometimes strip it back, see what's important. And you get lost in the white noise of it all, which is understandable as well. And I don't for a moment want to sound like I have this sorted. I fall into those traps continually, in terms of the missing the point and have to kind of hold the mirror up periodically and say, cop on, what's really important here? And I think that's the process, is trying to reground
You
ourselves
veer off, you
periodically. Yeah.
correct, you veer off, you correct. And it's about the child in front of you. Like, 'cause when I started parenting, I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I like to read a lot of information about things as well. So I was like, all the parenting books, all the philosophies. What kind of parent am I going to be? I'll follow the manual and do it the way I'm supposed to do it. So then I try all these things and it just wouldn't really work with, I'd see like people gentle parenting their children, for example. Darling, that's not how we do it, and blah, blah. And I would do that to my child, and he would just not hear. He would just ignore me, And he needs me to go, hey, blah, blah, blah. He needs like a declarative tone. He needs me to speak really clearly. And if I give him a million options, his brain fries. So if I'm like, darling, would you like to wear the green slippers or the blue slippers? His brain is fried by 9 a.m. Whereas if I just say, here's your green slippers, he's like, great, thanks. So what works for one child will not work for another child. And then, and I think that's the same all the way up. Like my oldest is nearly 7 now, so we're dealing with a lot more emotional stuff, a lot more interpersonal stuff. And
It's
there's no one size fits all.
like the saying, if you suggest that there's one way to parent, then you're suggesting there's one type of child.
Yeah, it's exactly it.
And that's not how that works.
It's like saying there's one way to be in a relationship, but every relationship you're in is different because you're in a relationship with someone different.
100%. And I think sometimes we struggle with that and say, but the other kid was fine when I did it this way. It's not about. And it's not even about your approach. It's about you just have to tailor it. He needs something different, and some children need kind of less is more and kind of protection from detail. And some people need to be kind of brought in and said the stuff happening here that you need to be aware of, and it's down. It's funny. There's a thing called temperament that you won't hear many psychologists, psychotherapists, or psychiatrists talk about. I think it's because we don't really understand it, but temperament is hugely important when it comes to who we are and how we respond and react to certain interventions. But I would be a fan of working with temperament, not against it. And I think it's an important consideration when considering what's the best approach here.
For sure, for sure. Who is this little child coming into the world? They come in with stuff. They are who they are. It's mad because I remember thinking, oh, before I ever had kids, oh, sure, I'm going to be like this kind of a parent, and my child will be this, that, and the other. And then you're like the second child, especially because the way you think you're an expert after you've had one, and you go, we'll have a second one now, and these are all the ways I'm going to do things differently. So this time it will be perfect. And then it's like there's this totally different person that in front of you going, none of that works on me, baby. So strap in. You're like, okay.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like reflexivity is a great skill to have. It's being able to respond and react in the moment. And it's interesting you said about perfectionism, and I think that's there's a blight on ourselves with that a little bit. And I think perfectionism is not about perhaps sometimes the drive to get it right, but more the fear of getting it wrong, that we over prepare. And I would say a lot of adolescents, both girls and young boys as well, perfectionism is a real issue, more so now than ever before. And again, it's because that perfect outcome is deemed to be possible.
Yeah, it's the same root cause. It's that broadcasting ourselves into the world. Can we talk a bit about technology before I let you go? Because, and I'm not going to make this a therapy session, but I really struggle as a parent with technology. It's just seems to be something that I never feel like I'm getting right. And I feel like I'm pushing the tide out with a fork. It's like these devices keep appearing in our house that people give us. Or my little boy, who's 7, is like obsessed with phones. He loves retro technology, which is like retro as in phones from the 2000s, like, but he wants to see how they're different to phones now, and he's really interested in exploring that. But he's also loves video games and blah blah blah, and he finds it really regulating. And I see him come in after a day from school, and he could be tweaked, and he comes in and he'll play Minecraft and just build a village, and then he will be much more chill and grounded, and he's gone internal and had a little, and I can see the value in it. Like, he's designing something, he's using his creative muscles, he's taking time to calm, he's regulating himself. And then I'm getting also the messages of like screen time is bad, and so I just haven't figured it out for myself, and I feel like I'm constantly trying to impose limits. And those limits get pushed then when it's like, oh, I haven't finished work and the kids are at home, and I'll extend the screen time, or I'm not being consistent around it at all. And I just find it particularly challenging.
Take solace in the fact that you're no different to everyone else. Nobody has this sorted. And despite the claims of people, this is a prefigurative society that we live in, which basically means the young are teaching the old. And I don't mean that in terms of my 12-year-old set up the parental controls on our Wi-Fi. It's not about that. It's, traditionally anything we've ever had, whether it be the motor car, printing press, whatever, it was handed down through the generations. So we've driven this car for years, and if you maintain it and put petrol in it and don't speed and don't drink and drive, you'll be fine. So here it is. This is not how technology has occurred, right? So we're trying to catch up with technology. So now, nobody has done this before to tell us how to do it. So as parents in the technological age, we are firefighting, trying to keep and we're getting all this contrasting advice. Many of which, the reality is, it hasn't been around long enough for us to know whether it's good or bad. We have some suspicions around it not. But the iPhone baby is only 14, so we've yet even to see the longer term impacts of it. So when you take it, I would say technology is like food, right? There's all different types, right? We don't measure our children's diet by how long they sit at the table. We measure their diet by what they consume, right? So content is much more specific and better metric of usage than time, right? So I could spend an hour on YouTube learning a song on a guitar, a tutorial, really useful use of my time. I'm learning a skill, I have something. Or I could spend the next hour going through Instagram, looking at everyone's new mantelpieces and feeling rotten about the how my house is so rubbish, right? The screen time metric will just say an hour each, but what I'm doing is vastly different. So my advice is, it's about time well spent rather than time spent, right? So if we're thinking about the technology diet, it's like you have your veg and your whatever it might be, the good stuff, and then you'll have a donut, and then you, so it's not that you should live a donutless life, but that you know where it comes after. So once I get my Zoom meeting done and my work done, then I'll scroll through TikTok for half an hour because I'm not doing my work because I'm on TikTok. So the idea of organizing our technological diet in that way, and that's what we want children to be able to do, is to be able to decipher between time spent and time well spent. And oftentimes that's dictated to by the bigger companies that they say, they hack our concentration, and they autoplay the next video, and they sinkholes and all those things that we get sucked into. So we have to be really, all of the responsibility of usage is down to the user, right? No, technology will give you what you want. It will never give you what you need. So it's not going to say, come here, you've had 25 donuts today. Would you not chance a drop of water? They're going to say, here's more donuts. So it puts a great deal of responsibility on the self-discipline of the individual to say, and as adults, we struggle with that. Children haven't got the capacity to self-regulate. They just simply cognitively, neuroscientifically, biologically cannot do it. If you left your child in charge of their diet for the day, they would eat rubbish and cereal or toast, but they wouldn't have anything else. So from the point of view of at what point in their lives could they take control of actually knowing I need to have this and that. And it's almost like the same thing. You don't say to a 5-year-old, here's a 2 liter of ice cream, have at it, come back to me when you vomit. You would say, this is a bowl and this is a portion and this is enough. Certain times you might give an extra scoop if you're busy and you're trying to do something. So that's all fine. Do you know what I mean? From the point of view, don't, I wouldn't be giving ourselves a hard time for needing to patch things in and patch things out. But it is a relationship with technology is no different to a relationship you have with food. If it's overly prohibitive, you have the child who goes to the neighbor's party and gorges on the Maltesers because they never get any of that at home. Do you know what I mean? The child who just constantly has a free rein of the tree press is going to have issues with food and all that sort of stuff as well. Child who's encouraged every time they're fall to eat sweets is going to have a problematic relationship with food. So all of these things are, we're mediating their relationship with it. And of course, that's part of that process is as the regulator, as the values, you're trying to say we have our dinner first and then we have our dessert. We have our breakfast and then we might have a treat. We do this and we do that. Those are the systems that we need to be putting in place. It's creating that relationship with technology that it's not about good and bad, and it's not about, your time is up, or, it's about educating children to be media literate, to be able to know this stuff is good for me, this not so much. Minecraft is kind of like virtual Lego. We wouldn't really have a problem with that, but because it's on a screen, we have an issue with where it's something bad because it's mediated through a screen. And again, it's always about seeing the risks and the opportunities. For me, the challenge for children is not that stuff, the screen time stuff. For me, it is being a 9-year-old and having to answer 70 Snapchat messages in the morning before I have my breakfast, right? And that's the issue I would have with my own use of technology. The most stressful app that I have on my phone is WhatsApp because I'm in 100 groups and they're pinging the whole time saying, fill out this form for training tonight, fill out this for tomorrow, that, we're doing a collection for Mrs. Murphy. You need to put something in for the raffle. That's the most stressful app that I have. So from the point of view of that's the exposure that I think is what will cause the issues within our children is that needing to be always on and that they're almost the, but, and I say this again as someone who's realistic, I think the reality is I wouldn't have a, I think there's an age where we shouldn't really be exposed to that. And I think the younger children are, the reality is more children at 11 now have phones that don't. So most of those 11-year-olds are on Snapchat than they're not. So we now have reached a point. Sorry, state of affairs, but if you're 11 and you don't have Snapchat, you miss out on the social world because all they're doing is communicating through this and talking about what they communicated with. We have reached an unfortunate watershed where the child without the technology now may be the one at risk, just mean of being excluded. And that's simply because we let this thing take over. The marketeers were and have been more popular than the naysayers or the warning people who are saying, we should really not do this. And you can see all the initiatives around keeping the smartphone ban until you finish primary school and all those things, which are really good initiatives and they're right. But I wonder if it's a bit like you and the fork and the tide, that idea of, and I know that sounds a bit fatalistic, but I've been having this battle for 10 years now, in terms of trying to see how we manage it. So rather than I'm realistic around, okay, if they're in their hands, we need to show them how to. So I'll finish on this. The work is with the humans, not the devices. It's about preparing children to navigate the world rather than trying to keep the world or to get the world to regulate itself. I don't see that happening. I don't think there's any appetite or initiative for that. And it's against the business model. So yes, delay it as long as we can, prepare them as long as we can, but maybe we need to have a better grasp of what it is that we are trying to teach them. Because I think as the grown-ups, we don't even have that yet.
We don't even
So.
know. Yeah, we don't even know. Wow, that was a really powerful and very profound conversation, Coleman. I'm definitely left specifically with this sense that one of the greatest malaises of the age we live in is this idea of perfection or trying to be perfect. And actually, the dangers of passing that on to our children and our endeavors to be the best parent that we could possibly be, that we're just passing on that idea that you must be the best at everything and you must be perfect at everything, and actually modeling, which I do try and do, modeling making a mistake and coming back and saying, "Jeez, you know, I wasn't actually angry at you. I was angry about this text that I got earlier, and I took it out on you, and I'm sorry."
But I would want to say this stuff is within our control. You know, we have to just collectively catch on to ourselves and kind of say, no, next time the report card comes in, I'm going to look at the first section I'm going to look at is socially, emotionally, how are they getting on? That's the bit I'm going to value. I look at the geography and the maths and all that after that. I'm not going to ask them, did you win? Did you score? I'm going to ask them, did you have fun? I'm not going to compete in the birthday party circuit to have the most impressive party bag that has been all year, because that's not what's important to me. And I'm going to take back control of all of this stuff. And then that's going to be my value system, because I'm going to be clear about what that is. And hopefully that will, you know, I can't control the other families and I can't control the other systems, but I do have a say in this. And I'm going to remind myself of that, you know, if we invest those values in your children will be able to navigate the world better with those, you know, offline, online, whatever it is, if they've good values within themselves. You know, the most and powerful relationship we all have in our lives is the relationship we have with ourselves. That's the one you need to nurture within your child, is that the relationship with themselves, yes, has all the levels of assertiveness and all that sort of stuff. But also, they have that they know their rights, they can stand up for themselves, but they also know their responsibilities to be kind, to reach out, to be decent human beings, you know. And that's, you know, for me, and I've worked in that this for 25 years, kids who are like that do fine. You know, they do. They'll hit the bumps in the road, they'll do all those things. They might have troublesome periods, but they know who they are and they have a good sense of themselves. That's kind of. Those kids do better than the 600 points in the leaving kids, you know. So, which kid do you want?
All right, bring back average.
Yeah, but I'd prefer to be happy in the middle than miserable at the top, you know.
Oh, big time. And I've seen so many people who I was in school with and everything who were, you know, the gifted child, the child that you expected were going to go on and do amazing things, and who have floundered in adulthood to try and find a path that sustains them. So, I think being somewhere in the middle and being very happy with it is actually a great place to be.
And it's an interesting question. I remember asking a parent this once, and I said, would you prefer your child to hit July with the 650 points in the leaving, but psychologically in tatters? Or do you want them to hit 350 points and be in good shape? Now, the mum had to think about that, but came to the second. You know, we all have to think about that. Do you know what I
You
mean?
really do.
Yeah.
You really do.
Where do you want? Where is our values? Because if you're just talking about study and study and study and study 24 hours a day to your child, that's what they're going to think that you value. Does that make sense?
100%. Coleman, thank you so much for your time. I'd like to shout out your book, The 4-7 Zone. Shout out your book, Cop On, which is what we all need more of, I think. And Asking for a Parent, which is also a brilliant resource, brilliant podcast. And also, I would like to shout out the interview that Brezzy did with you on the Where's My Mind podcast. And it was last April at this stage on ADHD. So, if you're interested in a very level-headed, very balanced conversation about ADHD in children, that's a really good resource. We didn't have time to get into it today, but thank you so much.
Not at all.
I
Pleasure.
really
Thanks for having
appreciate
me.
it. Thanks, Coleman. Thank you to all our listeners for joining us for this parenting podcast at A Lust for Life. We are committed to providing free, valuable resources and support to children and young people and families like yours, but we can't do it alone. If you found our podcast helpful and informative, please consider supporting our work by making a donation. To donate or learn more about our school's programs or campaigns, visit alustforlife.ie. Every donation, no matter how small, helps us reach more children with our early intervention programs in schools. Join us on the journey to change the face of mental health in Ireland. Thanks for listening.